I'm going to do something a little bit out of the ordinary for me. I was going through some of my old notes. I actually have a document on my computer that I kind of keep a running list of all my sermon ideas or different topics that I think ought to be addressed in the preaching and teaching from time to time. And I had a section down towards the bottom of that list that was labeled as suggestion box or question box lessons. And that's because you'll remember several years ago we used to have that suggestion box sitting out on the back table, and we encouraged the young people to put questions that they had in there with the promise that those questions would be answered sooner or later, and in this case, much later. I'll be honest, I had a whole smattering of questions in there that were just kind of all over the place. I didn't really, know how to categorize them. I didn't know that they necessarily justified a whole entire lesson all to themselves. And so I just kind of had them sitting in the bottom of that list, and I've decided that later has arrived. So we're going to address some of those questions that were asked maybe even several years ago. So you may recognize your question yet today. I don't know. Test your own memory on that. But that'll be the approach. So today's lesson may seem a little bit hodgepodge and scattered, and it may not be a true Bible study as far as meditating on a passage of Scripture or something like that. But hopefully we'll gain some things nonetheless out of our efforts together today. So the first question we'll address was the question, why did God make Indians? And you can understand why this one made it to the bottom of the list, because I didn't know exactly how to address that question, nor was I even 100% positive what Indians we were talking about in the question. I'm going to assume we're talking about Native American Indians. And so if that is the case, I think really maybe what might have prompted this young person to ask this question was maybe twofold, and we'll try to address both aspects of it. But the first being, why is there such variety among the people of the world? Why do we look so different from one another? And I think that it needs to be pointed out before we move any farther forward that all men and women, all of mankind, it doesn't matter where on the globe you presently reside or who your ancestry or your ethnicity or what nation you belong to, the reality is that all of us came from the same place. Paul, when he is preaching in Athens in Acts chapter 17, makes the observation in verse 26 that God made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times, and notice the boundaries of their habitation. So from one man, we would say from Adam and Eve, and then later through Noah and his three sons, but certainly through Adam and Eve, every person who lives today is a descendant of that first original couple. We all came from literally one man because Eve literally came from Adam. And so we all came from Adam. And so we're all related to one another. And yet we see a great diversity throughout the world. And that's because, as we've indicated, not only are we descendants of Adam and Eve, but you remember there was kind of that restart in the days of Noah with the great flood. And only eight people survived the flood, Noah and his wife, and then his three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and their three wives, which gets us to eight people. And it's from those eight people, then, that all of us are descended today. And in Genesis chapter 10, we have what sometimes is referred to as the Table of Nations. This is my own chart that I've made of what is talked about in that text there. It basically covers from the three sons of Noah, Japheth, Ham, and Shem. It covers five generations following them. And from these men, these fathers of households, became fathers of tribes and then ultimately fathers of nations. You'll notice in Genesis chapter 10 and in verse 32, after this rather exhaustive and lengthy list of a bunch of names that are really hard to pronounce, it says, "These are the families of the sons of Noah according to their genealogies, by their nations, and out of these the nations were separated on the earth after the flood." And so I can say with absolute confidence that we are descendants of some of these people here. We think, well, how did that work? In fact, it was interesting, just earlier this week, Colton asked me and Stephanie the question. He said, how come our name isn't in that list? Where do we fit in the sons of Noah? Why isn't there a Ligon up there? And I said, well, that's because the Ligons probably came many, many generations later. In fact, if we look at a map, the people of Noah's family, when they came off of the ark in Mount Ararat, which is probably up towards maybe Nineveh and Calah up there on our map, they traveled southeast towards the Valley of Shinar. And there we remember the story of the Tower of Babel when God came down and confused their languages and scattered the people throughout all the earth. And in chapter 10, we have the list of the nations. And so kind of color coded here, you've got Japheth's descendants. They all kind of migrated north and to the west, became the ancestors of the European peoples today. Ham, who's going to be in green on our map, he migrated to the south and the west. Much of Africa and African nations would be descendants of Ham. And then Shem, he kind of hung out there in the Middle East and then migrated also some to the east, to Asia, India, and beyond. And so I think, well, where do we fit on that table of nations? Well, if you are from European descent, which Ligon, I found out after doing some research, is actually from Anglo-Saxon origin, and I think it means something like the spear of a wolf or something. I don't know. That's kind of cool. But anyway, but it's from Anglo-Saxon origin, which means we're European as our ancestry, at least my name. And so we are more than likely descendants of Japheth. And if you are from European ancestry, then that's more than likely your forefather. You came from Japheth's branch of Noah's family. Yeah, we think about that. Why is it that if we all came from the same family, why do we all look so different from one another? You know? Well, it has some to do with what we've already referred to, the Tower of Babel there. Remember, they came off of Mount Ararat and they traveled towards the Valley of Shinar and they built a city there. Ultimately, the name of the city would become Babel. But it was in that city that man began to build this great tower to reach to heaven. And I think that that's kind of somewhat figurative in the language there. It wasn't that they were trying to get up to where God was necessarily, but they were trying to make a tower that reached so high that it would be like a beacon, so that even from miles and miles and miles away, you would be able to look back in the direction of the great tower and you would see this central beacon, this thing that binds mankind together. Because you'll remember that when Noah and his family came off of the ark in Genesis chapter 9, one of the first things God says to him in verse 1 is that God blessed Noah and his sons, and he said, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." God's intent was that mankind would spread out and fill the earth, that populate the globe. And in the story of the Tower of Babel, we have man's efforts to go against God's directive. No, don't spread out. Let's clump up. Let's stay together. And so, of course, as a result, God came down and confused their language so that they couldn't communicate with one another, kind of forcing them to fulfill his command to not just be fruitful and multiply, but also to go out and fill the earth. And so, if we were to zoom out from this area on the map to the globe, okay, to the world map, from the Middle East then, from Babel, at the Tower of Babel and the scattering of people, they went out from there and they began to go throughout all the earth and disperse. And as they traveled And as generation after generation grew up now in different environments and in different climates, we began to see what we might call either microevolution, or perhaps maybe you don't like that idea of evolution, so you might want to use the term environmental adaptation. Okay? That is, we changed physically, we adapted to the various environments in which man migrated. And so that's why, one of the reasons anyway, why we see such a variety in the color of skin and the shape of faces and stature and things like that. So for example, if you live close to the equator or in a hot, warm climate, you had darker skin ultimately developed. And that was a protection against the heat of the sun. In fact, it's interesting, when my dad goes over to West Africa to preach over there, usually the group that he goes with, they're the only white people over there. And if they're out preaching along the side of the road or gathered in a little grove of trees or something like that, preaching outdoors, and oftentimes my dad wouldn't even think about it. He would just stand in wherever he was and begin to preach and teach. And oftentimes some of the black brethren would say, "Oh no, you... Brother Rick, you need to come stand over here. Come stand in the shade, because his pale white skin is not going to protect him from the heat of that sun. He needs to be in the shade." Now, they can handle it a little bit better because through generation after generation, their bodies have adapted to be able to handle that kind of a climate. That's why you see in like the Northern Europeans, the Vikings, right? Those who lived in these colder climates, they developed a long, slender nose, kind of the pointy European nose. And that was an adaptation because the air is cold. And anatomically, I guess, that helps to heat up the air, the cold, dry air, before it gets all the way to your lungs. And so that's an adaptation, but it's a physical change and makes people look different. Again, the farther away from the equator, the closer you are to the equator, typically, peoples who live in the tropical regions have, again, the darker skin, but they're also tall and lanky. And that's because their bodies are more accustomed to be able to put off heat or give off heat rather than conserve heat, because their environment's already hot. We don't want to be hotter than we have to be. So you see the tall, lanky guys in Kenya, and then you got the Inuit people who live up in North America, and they are short and squatty and stout. And that's because their bodies have adapted to conserve heat because they live in cold environments. And so because of some of these things, this is just a few examples, we see a variety within mankind, even though we all came from one single family. Now, I think maybe the other part of the question is, especially related to Native American Indians, is how in the world, if we all came from the Middle East, how did Indians get to the Americas? How are there people here on this totally different continent, or North and South America, two different continents, that are surrounded by ocean and water? How did that happen? Well, one popular theory is what is referred to as Pangaea, which is basically the idea that there was an ancient supercontinent. In fact, a map of it may look something like that, where you had all seven continents, from Asia all the way to Australia, or Antarctica rather, together in one continent. And that over millions and billions of years, as the tectonic plates of the earth have shifted and moved around, these continents that at one point were all clumped together have slowly drifted apart to form what we think of as the world map today. And there is some evidence that continents and tectonic plates are moving and things are shifting around. But at the rate they're going, it would have taken billions of years for this kind of transformation of the globe to take place. I don't know that that's a necessary explanation. Of course, it is kind of nice if everybody starts out on one supercontinent, then as man spreads out, the continents spread out, and that explains how we get people that are living even on these small islands out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, right? But I don't think that that's necessary. Now, others have suggested that it's because of ice ages, these long periods of time where vast portions of the globe were covered in ice. And so that allowed man to be able to traverse over basically frozen oceans to get from one continent to another. And you think about that, when you're looking at the world map, you think, you know, maybe that could have worked, but that's a lot of ocean we're talking about, right? I mean, how did people from Asia get all the way over here to North America? How does that happen? It's so far apart, right? Well, what we forget, and what I sometimes forget when I'm looking at a world map like this, is that the Earth, get ready for something crazy, it's not flat, despite what some people may tell you today. It's actually a globe, guys. Let's see if we can get to it here. It's actually a globe. It's round. It's a sphere. And so we're looking at basically that same area in the center of the map. Now I've just wrapped it around the globe. We're looking at the Atlantic Ocean. You can see South America there. And if we move around on the map just a little bit, we'll see if it'll go. Here we go. Coming around to North America, that's the United States. That looks pretty familiar to us, right? If you keep going up to our most northern state, the state of Alaska, you realize that that's Alaska and that's Russia right there. So if you zoom in on that, it's called the Bering Strait. There's only about 55 miles of ocean that separate Russia from the United States, that separate Asia from North America. And my understanding is that even up until a few years ago, it was not uncommon for that Bering Strait to freeze over every year during the winter months, creating a traversable, essentially, ice bridge from Asia into North America. When you realize how close those continents actually are, something we don't ever think about because on our mind, Americas are always over here on the left, and Asia is always over here on the right. They're on opposite ends. No, they're not. They're actually right together. So I would suggest to you that it's quite feasible, even without extended ice ages, for there to be these ice bridges that developed that provided a means for man to travel by foot from the Middle East all the way to the tip of South America within a matter of a few years. It's not out of the reign of possibility. But that still doesn't answer the question of how did people end up on the islands, right? That one's a little bit more troubling. And let me just remind the Bible student that every man who has ever lived is the direct descendant of one of the greatest shipbuilders and sailors that there ever was. You remember, we all came from a guy who survived the universal flood by building a boat that could sail across oceans. And so I don't think that that would have been technology or information or knowledge that would not have been passed down from generation to generation. And so, you know, we talk about, well, ancient man couldn't have sailed that far. There's actually some historical evidence of sailing boats being depicted in Egyptian pottery as early as 3500 BC, which, as I'll share with you in a little bit, is roughly around the time of the flood. Actually predates the flood a little bit. But anyway, we'll talk about that in a second. So it's not impossible or unheard of that ancient man could have made ships and boats that sailed across the seas and the oceans to make it from one continent to the other. I think it's quite a feasible possibility. So hopefully that addresses the question of the Indians a little bit. Let's look at another question that was asked. How do we know exactly what year the earth was created? Well, the short answer is this: we don't. We don't know exactly what year the earth was created. However, there are some key biblical events whose dates we do know, which are very firmly established from a historical perspective. And if we know certain dates, we can work from these dates either forwards or backwards in order to determine roughly the dates of other events in the biblical record that we may not be so sure about. So one of these well-established dates is actually the date of which Solomon began building his temple. That's recorded for us in 1 Kings chapter 6. We'll look at that verse in just a moment. But history tells us, and this is a fairly well-established date, is that Solomon began building his temple in the year 966 B.C. So now that we have this well-established date, we can work backwards from that towards the point of the creation of Adam. And we can actually get all the way there without any interruptions just from what is recorded for us in the Old Testament. So you'll notice there in 1 Kings chapter 6 and verse 1, it says, "Now it came about in the 480th year after the sons of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, he began to build the house of the Lord." So this momentous event in the reign of King Solomon, which was the fourth year of his reign, occurred 480 years after the Israelites exited from Egypt. Well, what's interesting, you go back to the book of Exodus to see when they left Egypt. We're given another chronological marker there in Exodus chapter 12 and in verse 41. There we read, "At the end of 430 years, to the very day, all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt." Let's actually start in verse 40. Verse 40 says, "Now the time that the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years, and at the end of 430 years, to the very day, all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt." So how long were the Israelites in Egypt? How long did they live there? Well, the text says a total of 430 years to the day. That's pretty precise. And I think that that's probably a reference to when Jacob and his 11 other sons, because remember, Joseph was already down in Egypt. It's when Jacob and his other 11 sons and their families, the 70 peoples in all, moved down to Egypt. And what's interesting, if we track backwards in the biblical record, we find in Genesis chapter 47 that Jacob himself says how old he is when he came down to Egypt. In Genesis chapter 47 and in verse 9, when he's speaking to Pharaoh, he says, "The years of my sojourning are 130. Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained the years that my fathers lived during the days of their sojourning." And Jacob says, when he's standing before Pharaoh after just arriving in Egypt, he says, "I've lived 130 years at this point in my life, and it's not been a very pleasant life." That was Jacob's commentary on his own life. We think, well, who was Jacob's father? Well, Jacob's father was Isaac. And we're actually told how old Isaac was when Jacob was born in Genesis chapter 25 and in verse 26. We read there, got to get to chapter 25. There we go. Chapter 25 and verse 26. "Afterward, his brother came forth with his hand holding onto Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to the twins." So Isaac was 60 when Jacob was born. Jacob was 130 when he moved to Egypt. The Israelites lived in Egypt 430 years. And 480 years after that, Solomon began to build his temple. Do you see how we're going to get ready to do our math here in just a second? Let me give you one more piece of information. Because Isaac's father was Abraham, and we're told in Genesis chapter 21 and verse 5 that Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born. And so now we can stretch all the way from the birth of Abraham to the building of Solomon's temple with an unbroken chain of chronology. And if you add all of those years, the 480 plus the 430 plus 130 plus 60 plus 100 to the 966 BC, that puts Abraham being born roughly around 2166 BC. And now that we've established the rough year in which Abraham is born, we can work even further back by looking at the genealogies in Genesis chapter 11 and Genesis chapter 5. Let's continue to work our way backwards. Let's first look at the genealogy in Genesis chapter 11. There you've got all these descendants of Shem. We read in verse 11, Shem lived 500 years after he became the father. Let's start in verse 10. These are the records of the generation of Shem. Shem was 100 years old when he became the father of Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. Verse 12 says, Arpachshad lived 35 years and he became the father of Shelah. Verse 14, Shelah lived 30 years. He became the father of Eber. And so on and so forth down the list. We're given the name of the father and how old they were when their next son in the list was born. And what we can do if we take all those years and we add them up is we come up with a grand total of 390 years. You're welcome to double check my math on that. But there's something we need to note here because it says in verse 26, that Terah, who is the father of Abram, says that he lived 70 years. And notice this, he became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Well, let me just tell you, Abram, Nahor, and Haran were not triplets. They were not all born at the same time. What the text is saying here is that when Terah was 70 years old, that's when the first of these three was born. I know that that's the case because Terah must have been actually 130 years old when Abram was born. You notice in the text in verse 32, it says, the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. And then the narrative continues, chapter 12 and verse 1, now, that is after this, the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country, from your relatives, and from your father's house to the land which I'll show you, and I'll make you a great nation, and I'll bless you, and make your name great, so that you shall be a blessing. And I'll bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I'll curse, and in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. So Abram went forth, as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. Notice the end of verse 4. Now Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Now, if Terah died in Haran before Abram departed from there, that means you take 205 minus 75 and you come up with the age of 130 for Haran, or Terah rather, when Abram was born. So we have to do a little bit of investigative work here to find out precise years. But if that's the case, we need to add an additional 60 years to our 390, which brings us to a grand total of 450 years between Shem and Abraham. Okay? And then we go to our genealogy in Genesis chapter 5. It's very much the same kind of idea. You've got the father listed. This is how old he was when his son was born, et cetera, all the way down the line. You add all those numbers together, significantly more, 1,556 years between the creation of Adam and when Noah's son Shem is born, or Shem, Ham, and Japheth. But we have a similar thing happening here with Noah in Genesis chapter 5 and verse 32. It says, Noah was 500 years old, and Noah became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Again, three boys listed there. And again, they're not triplets. But Noah was 500 years old when the first of the three was born. And actually, if you look at Genesis chapter 11 and verse 10, which we already saw, Shem, which is the son of interest for our chronology, was 100 years old when his son was born 2 years after the flood, which means that Shem was only 98 years old the year of the flood. And we read in Genesis chapter 7 and in verse 6 that Noah was 600 years old when the flood came. That means that if Noah was 600 years old when Shem was 98 years old, Noah was 502 years old when Shem was born, which means we need to add two additional years to our 1556 to get us to 1558 total years between Adam and Shem. You following me so far? Okay. If we add all of those dates together, all of those years, to the known date of 966 B.C., we work ourselves all the way back to the year 4174 B.C. as the year that Adam was created. That means, guys, that the earth, based on a literal reading of the text, assuming that there aren't any generations skipped over in these genealogies in Genesis chapter 5 or Genesis chapter 11, and using round years, the earth is not much older than 6,000 years. And you think to yourself, well, hold on a second. It's only 2021. How could the world be older than the year? How does that work? Well, thank you, Gregorian calendar, which was actually introduced as recently as 1582 by a church bull, by the Pope, Gregory the 13th. He basically said, this is the rule now in the church. This is the calendar we're going to use. And the Gregorian calendar actually replaced the Julian calendar. Really, it was just a minor correction of the Julian calendar. You see, the Julian calendar calculated the year as being 365.25 days long, whereas the actual solar year is closer to 365.2425 days long. You think that's not a big deal. Well, every 128 years, the Julian calendar was adding an additional year or additional day to the calendar. And that was throwing things off. And after many centuries of that, you get to a point where it's supposed to be on the calendar, the spring planting. And yet that would happen. Wait a minute. That happened 11, 12 days ago. We're off, right? So the calendar was out of sync with the actual solar year. And so there needed to be an adjustment. And so Pope Gregory said, commissioned a group of people to come up with a solution, and the calendar that was adopted was the Gregorian calendar, named after him. What's interesting is that the Julian calendar was used throughout most of the Roman world for close to then 1600 years, because it was put in place under Julius Caesar, who originated that under his rule. And what's interesting about the Julian calendar is that years on the Julian calendar were not numbered originally. They were named. And they were named after whatever proconsul was reigning that particular year. The Roman proconsuls would reign for 1 year. And that year that they reigned, that became the name of that year. Well, you could understand how if you're trying to work out some sort of a chronology and having figure out how many years was it between the proconsulship of Julius and the proconsulship of Peter or whatever, those aren't numbers to add together. So you would have to memorize these great exhaustive lists of all the names of the Roman years, and then you'd have to go through and count all of the years in order to figure out how much time had elapsed between this event that happened in this year and this event that happened in this year. Which is why in much of the Roman histories that are written down, years were not named, but they were counted from a fixed point in Roman history, specifically the founding of the city of Rome, which on the Gregorian calendar corresponds to 753 BC. But they call that year one. Year one, AUC, or Ab Urbe Condita, which means the year of the founding of the city. And so they counted everything from the founding of Rome. Of course, that's not the system that we're familiar with today. We're familiar with a system that's called BC and AD. Now, I would venture to say if I asked a group today, what does BC stand for? Almost everybody would say it stands for before Christ, right? I'm confident you guys would know that. If I were to ask you, what does AD stand for? I would venture to say that roughly half of you would say after death. But that's not correct. AD actually comes from the Latin Anno Domini, which means the year of our Lord. If we counted everything before Christ and then after his death, we've got a chunk of the life of Christ where we have no dates for anything. So this BC, before Christ, came all the way up until the year that Christ was born. And then when he was born, it became 1 AD, or 1, the year of our Lord, 1. And thus we started counting forward. But that was a relatively late development. In fact, the Julian calendar existed for hundreds of years, many centuries before this BC AD system, in which everything was calculated from the hub of Christ's birth, was even invented. It actually wasn't invented until AD 522 by a monk by the name of Dionysius Exiguus. And the reason why he changed his years and started numbering them in relationship to the birth of Christ, the incarnation of Christ, was because under the Julian calendar, the names were being given to the Roman rulers, who were oftentimes persecutors of Christians. And he, as a Christian, was tired of giving credit to these enemies of the church for the names of the years. So he said, instead of naming the years, let's just date everything from the birth of Christ. And so he developed and he calculated roughly when, what year was Christ born, and he used that as year one. And then he began to convert dates to this system that we're familiar with. Unfortunately, that didn't really catch on until the middle of the 8th century when Bede, a Benedictine monk in England, used Dionysius' system in his history, ecclesiastical history of the English people, which he published in AD 731. And from that point forward, then at least in the Roman Christian world, this system of dating things by AD and BC became a pretty common feature of calendars. So that was then incorporated into the Gregorian calendar's update. And the years were from then on labeled by the number in relationship to the birth of Christ. I've got one more question that really naturally leads into that could be addressed, but I'm not in the interest of making this a super long sermon. So we're going to put a peg in it there, and we'll come back. I'll leave you to ponder this question, though. How was Christ born before Christ? That's the question that was asked. We'll have to address that at another time. But I hope that this has been encouraging, or at least enlightening and instructive. Because I think sometimes what happens is skeptics like to try to poke holes in the Bible. They like to try to make it sound like it contradicts, or it's crazy, or it couldn't possibly make sense, that it's inconsistent with science, that it's inconsistent with what's known in history. And there may be some things that on their surface, they first do appear to be like, wait a minute, how does that work? That does seem weird. And yet when we start to dig into it, there's a reasonable, logical, rational explanation. So I just want to say this as I wrap up this lesson, especially to the young people. You know, sometimes it was pretty popular to, when young people ask tough questions, to just kind of say, Don't worry about that. It just is. And that was a disservice to young people. And that was a disservice to our faith. So I want to encourage not just the young people, but the old people too, but especially the young people. Don't ever be afraid to question things. Don't ever be afraid to ask somebody older than you those tough questions. And don't take a for an answer. You deserve better than that. And the answer is there to be found. Because I believe this with all of my heart, that God's word is the truth. And truth will always triumph and overcome any and all scrutiny that can be thrown up against it. So keep asking those good questions, guys. And if you do, I'll try to take time to answer, if not sooner, later. Thank you for your attention this morning.